No, that book that Dave was talking about that we've just included in our catalog, it's a debate book. It's a debate book on science, faith, the Bible, on the subject of Adam. And just so you know, Fuzz and I are working on an update of the book, Who is Adam? What we're going to do is basically release the book as is with an addendum, because everything in the book still stands, but there's now a much stronger case for what's in the book. And Fuzz is working on it first, and so far he's up to about 25,000 to 30,000 words. So it's not exactly a small addendum. And then I'm going to add my part, so it's going to be a little bit thicker. So, if you were at the first service, I mentioned that we are releasing our latest book, Navigating Genesis, this week. It's going to be coming to our office on Tuesday. And those of you who are part of our mailing list will have already... Well, a letter has been sent out announcing the release of the book. And if you recall, about 15 years ago, I wrote a book called The Genesis Question. And this has the same theme, the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and how we can get people past that barrier. But this is a total rewrite, and it's quite a bit bigger than the first book. But we can make a far stronger case, and really our motivation is, even though we're in the 21st century, it still ranks as the number one reason why people don't give their lives to Christ here in America, their inability to reconcile those opening chapters of Genesis with a scientific record. And so if you get it, you'll see that we really have a far stronger case that this indeed is the inspired and inerrant Word of God. But it amazes me as I speak in seminaries, running into these professors of theology who say it's impossible to reconcile Genesis with the record of nature. And that's how I came to faith in Christ, was realizing that they can be reconciled. But it still amazes me how many people are convinced. And it just shows you the power of young earth creationism and theistic evolution, that that's still the prevailing view in the church, that they can't be reconciled. And therefore I run into Christians who basically lead a double life. They believe science from Monday, Tuesday through to Saturday, and they believe the Bible on Sunday. Or I run into non-Christians who say, I can't become a Christian because these two things can't be reconciled. And I remember sharing in the worship service this morning, and when I spoke in San Antonio a couple of Sundays ago, 190 people, more than 190 people, stood up to give their lives to Christ. And I got to talk to a lot of them afterwards. And it was so interesting meeting all these atheists, predominantly men, who said, you know, everybody thought I was an atheist, but the truth is there was only one thing keeping me in the atheist camp, and that was the opening chapters of Genesis. And today you took care of that, and that's all I needed. That's why I stood up to give my life to Christ. So, hallelujah. But it actually shows why this book is going to be necessary. And incidentally, we're going to be releasing probably in June or July an 8-part DVD series. And it's where I teach a group of young people on Genesis, just basically Genesis 1. We didn't get into the other chapters, but the first chapter of Genesis. And what I love about the audience, none of them have heard of Reasons to Believe. A lot of them weren't even believers. But we got them to go through the series by saying, if you actually sit through the entire series, we'll give you an iPad. So we had them sign a contract, no iPad unless they sit through the whole series. So that's how we were able to get people who had never heard of us, some who weren't even believers. But the other thing was all 15 of the participants volunteered to be interviewed after the series was done about the impact it had on them. Every one of them said it changed their life. And the most enthusiastic responses came from the unbelievers. Right, this one unbeliever said, I'm buying every book that Reasons to Believe puts out. This is just so exciting stuff. He says, this is what was stopping me from becoming a Christian. So, you know, I was sharing this morning because Pastor Paul Beck was saying, well, you know, how do you write books? And I said, well, usually it takes 5 years from start to finish. Because, you know, about 3 years is basically reading the literature and studying the Bible, seeing it all put together, and then you begin to write it. Then it takes a year for our team to edit it. So it really is a 5-year project. I produce more books than that, but that's because I usually work on several books at once. But I wanted to begin this class by sharing something with you that actually I was researching just this past week, and it's something called the late veneer. Any of you ever heard of the late veneer? Okay, well, I've actually talked to a lot of scientists. I've talked to astronomers and physicists who have never heard of the late veneer. And yet it's been a subject of research for the past 25 years, the late veneer. Okay, you heard me speak about the moon-forming event, how there was this planet about twice the size of Mars that crashed into the Earth, and that's how we get the moon. But that event also eliminated every trace of water and atmosphere on the face of the Earth. And so after the moon-forming event, our planet Earth was just like the moon. There was no atmosphere. There was no water. Now, how we got the water and how we got the atmosphere is through something called the late veneer. And the other thing that happens with the moon-forming event is that the inner solar system is now in chaos. Because you've got these big bodies, I mean the one that collided with the Earth, they actually call it Theia. So that's if you ever want to know what the fifth planet is, it was called Theia. That's the one that crashed into the Earth and got obliterated. That event basically threw Mars, Venus, Mercury, and the Earth into chaotic orbits. What do I mean by chaotic orbits? It's where they now had highly elliptical orbits. So where the planet would go a long ways from the Sun in part of its orbit and close to the Sun other parts of the orbit. By the way, all planetary orbits are elliptical. None of them are circular. But the amazing thing about our solar system is that all the planets are really close to circular, except Mercury. Mercury for good reason. It's very tiny. Mercury is only 1/19th the mass of planet Earth. So it's roughly the same size as the biggest of Jupiter's moons. And actually, the late veneer made Mercury smaller. Mercury at one time was bigger. Because of the late veneer, it got eroded and became a smaller body. But it has still a fairly chaotic orbit. It's tilted at an angle relative to the plane of the solar system, and it's got an elliptical orbit. But it's so tiny and so close to the Sun, it doesn't do any harm to the orbital stability of the other seven planets. But yeah, look at the other seven planets. They all have circular orbits. They're very close to circular orbits. But that was not the case at the time of the moon-forming event. The planetary orbits were tilted relatively at different angles relative to the plane of the solar system, and they were highly elliptical. But it was the late veneer, and the late veneer is basically a collection of small asteroids. Anything from, say, a meter across up to about 1,000 kilometers across. But predominantly bodies that are like 10 to 100, a couple hundred meters across. And what's happening was that the rocky planets, that means Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, were dynamically interacting with this late veneer. And it's that interaction with the late veneer that transforms the orbits from highly elliptical and highly inclined into being almost circular and coplanar. And that's a crucial requirement for advanced life. If you're a bacterium, you might be able to handle a little bit of inclination or eccentricity, but if you're an animal or an advanced plant, you're going to want all the planets in the solar system to have circular orbits or very close to circular orbits and coplanar orbits. Otherwise, you're going to have the orbit of Earth being disturbed by the inclinations and the eccentricities of the other planets. So thanks to the late veneer, we have this circularization taking place. But it's crucial that the late veneer be timed. You want it to be several tens of millions of years after the moon-forming event. And so that indeed we now know to be the case. We know that because of measurements done in Australia, where we look at the oldest rocks there, and it actually tells us that indeed the late veneer occurred about 100 million years, or peaked about 100 million years, after the moon-forming event. Now, that's the first thing the late veneer did for us. The second thing it did for us is that it brought what are called siderophile elements. Ever heard of that term, siderophile elements? File means lover. So what it means is iron-loving elements. And wherever you got iron, you got cobalt and nickel. Cobalt and nickel are iron-loving elements. They like to hang out with iron. But there's several other elements that like to hang out with iron. Gold is an example. Manganese is an example. And all the platinum group. Now, it was thanks to the late veneer that the crust of the earth and the upper mantle got loaded up with these iron-loving elements. Now, think about it. What if we were on the planet where there was no gold, no cobalt, no nickel, and none of the platinum group elements? You could have a Stone Age, but you wouldn't be able to have advanced technology. And we wouldn't have the iron we needed either. And so, thanks to the late veneer, we have on the surface of the Earth and the deep crust of the Earth these elements. And what's interesting, too, is that you're going to get certain ones of these stony asteroids and metal asteroids that are going to bring rich deposits. For example, 80% of the gold that we mine here on planet Earth comes from a certain region just outside Johannesburg in South Africa. And they recognize that that gold is there because of a collision event. Likewise, we have an event in a mine in Canada, Sudbury. It's a city of 100,000 people, and it was founded based on mining nickel from a collider event. 50% of our nickel comes from that one source. So that's a second contribution. We get the elements we need to launch and sustain advanced civilization. A third benefit, that's where we get our water and our atmosphere. These asteroids that collided with the Earth were predominantly what we call chondritic asteroids or carbonaceous asteroids, which means they were wet. So these are wet asteroids that collide with the Earth and provide the water that gives our ocean and also provides us with the atmosphere that we need. So now, that obviously has to be fine-tuned. Now, what if it delivers too much water? If it delivers too much water, the oceans will be so deep, you'll never get continents. And if you never get continents, then you're not going to be able to recycle nutrients, and you won't be able to have life on planet Earth for anything more than, say, 1 million years. That would be the maximum. But if you've got too little water, then that's not going to be able to set up the plate tectonics, and you're not going to be able to have the rainfall you're going to need on the continental land masses. So, for example, if you don't have a surface of planet Earth where it's 70% liquid water, you're not going to have enough of that water evaporate to have rain on the continental land masses. So the water has to be fine-tuned. Too much is a problem, too little is a problem. The atmosphere, likewise, has to be fine-tuned. Now, in terms of having active animals that can live for a long time and enjoy life for a long time, you're going to need lungs. Gills are the next best thing. But really, if you want to have the greatest activity, be able to be the most productive in front of the Lord, you're going to need lungs. And you can read a book. It's called Nature's Destiny. And I'm trying to think of the author. It's an Australian scientist who wrote the book. It's actually something you can see in the Reasons to Believe catalog. But he's got an entire chapter where as a medical doctor and as an engineer, he describes why lungs is the only way to go. Lungs are something very close to it. So any other respiration system will simply not allow enough activity for a sufficient period of time. Lungs is the only way to go. And the problem with lungs is that you've got to get the air that you take in, the oxygen you take in, and get it distributed to all parts of the body. And the lungs need to be able to bring that into contact with the blood, which means you're going to need trachea and a lot of subtrachea in order to make it all work. Bottom line is, for lungs to function, you've got to have the right air pressure. And the way our lungs work is that if the air pressure were to drop by one-third, you die. So, for example, if you join a mountaineering party and go up Mount Everest, you do not want to spend a lot of time above 26,000 feet. They call it the death zone. And so once you get above the 26,000-foot level, brain cells start to die, and they won't be replaced. And so the goal is when you climb, say, K2 or Mount Everest, you get to the summit and you get back in less than one day. Because if you take more than a day, it's going to do permanent damage that's not going to be pleasant. And, you know, they take oxygen with them, but the problem is you can't carry enough oxygen to get you through the whole climb and back. Oxygen just is basically a supplement. And so even with the oxygen canisters, you're on the way to dying. And everybody I know that's climbed Mount Everest, you come back with muscle loss, weight loss, and brain cell loss. Yes?
The early manned space program, they used to reduce atmospheric pressure with pure oxygen. Of course, you know why that changed, but that was to overcome that situation. Was that less than this critical one-third less than atmospheric pressure, and was the oxygen able to overcome that over a longer period of time in space flight?
Well, you know, this is something that was done back in the 1950s with you know, fighter pilots. They would give them pure oxygen, but was at a reduced air pressure. And the whole idea was, as you mentioned, overcome the lack of pressure by boosting the oxygen content up. However, they quickly stopped that. I knew one of those fighter pilots growing up, and he didn't make it past age 50. And it was the oxygen that killed him. And so breathing pure oxygen, even at a reduced air pressure, does permanent damage. So that's not done anymore. But here's the other problem. You also can't go down or have too great an air pressure. So, for example, it's about a factor of 3 either way. If you were to try to breathe air that had 3 times the air pressure of sea level, then suddenly the lungs are not able to work. Why? Because there's just too much viscosity of the air trying to flow through the trachea, and the oxygen just can't get to the blood vessels. And so that's a problem, for example, with deep-sea divers. In fact, by the way, if you go to the Dead Sea, you'll notice it's a lot harder to breathe when you're at the deep Dead Sea. You're 1,350 feet below sea level. And I've been there, and it's quite an experience to see how difficult it is to breathe at that level. Now, what's the air pressure there? It's about 50% greater than it is at sea level. So even then you notice it. When you get to a factor of 3, it kills you. So you'll die if it's 3 times higher. You'll die if it's 3 times lower. What's ideal? Right where you are right now in this classroom. This is ideal. So come to class every Sunday because you're being exposed to the ideal air pressure for your lungs to function at maximum efficiency. Yes?
How can asteroids and comets deliver atmosphere?
Well, okay. They come to us with water in frozen form. They come to us with carbon dioxide in frozen form and carbon monoxide in frozen form. So there's all these what we call volatiles. But they come from
gases.
Yeah. So volatiles are gases and liquids. But in these asteroids, they're in frozen form. But as they come into the Earth and crash into the Earth, they get released as liquids and gases. But because the Earth has sufficient mass, it's able to keep those, and that's how we get the atmosphere.
And then the oxygen came from photosynthesis after that.
Well, oxygen was always here. Once you get past this, you know, late veneer.
But
the oxygen is not in the atmosphere. It's in, you know, it's. So you got to get it, you know, out of the crust of the Earth. For example, the crust of planet Earth is 50% oxygen. So there's lots of oxygen. But yeah, when we're talking about just before the origin of life, the quantity of oxygen in the atmosphere is actually less than 1%. So, by the way, that less than 1% is enough to stop a naturalistic pathway for the origin of life. Even that tiny amount of oxygen kills the possibility for any naturalistic pathway for life's origin. That's one of the reasons why we're convinced that the origin of life is a supernatural event, because of the fact that there's oxygen. So, and by the way, when you got water, you got oxygen. I mean, even if there was no oxygen in the atmosphere at all at the time of the origin of life, there would be, because of the fact that you've got all this uranium and thorium in the interior of the Earth and in the crust of the Earth. And that releases radiation. That radiation goes through the water. As it goes through the water, it separates some of those water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen. And that's why you can actually have life in the oceans. Back 3.8 billion years ago, there's dissolved oxygen in the water automatically because of the radiation. And some of that percolates up into the atmosphere. And that's why you can't have a naturalistic pathway for the origin of life. There's oxygen in the oceans. There's oxygen in the atmosphere. Not a lot, but enough to stop a chemical pathway for the origin of life. But yeah, how we got to 21% oxygen is through photosynthesis. And by the way, photosynthesis unimpeded could get the oxygen level up to about 21% in just a few million years. But it took over 3 billion years to get it up there. Why? Because you got these oxygen sinks. So at the origin of life, for example, you had a lot of rocks on the surface of the Earth that were oxygen starved. So all the oxygen that the photosynthetic life produced was immediately sucked up into these minerals in the crust of the Earth. Excuse me. Springtime, allergies creep up on me. So, yeah, it literally takes billions of years to saturate the crust of the Earth and the upper mantle of the Earth with enough oxygen that finally you can get the oxygen kind of coming up. I could try to pull a graph up here for you. Maybe I'll do that sometime. We can actually calculate the oxygen content of the atmosphere with respect to time. And it's kind of flat at 1% for billions of years. 2 billion years ago, it goes up to about 3.5%. Then it drops back down to 1%, stays at 1% until 550 million years ago. Then it immediately jumps up to 8%. Very quickly jumps up to 8%.
You have a graph of that in your book, Why the Universe.
I do have a graph of that, yes. So, although we have a new graph now. That's an update from that graph there, which will be in the new book. So, because what we're now able to see is that the increase in oxygen was sudden. And that's because there came a time about 550 million years ago when the sinks got filled. And once the sinks got filled, photosynthetic life rapidly pumped a lot of oxygen in the atmosphere, and as soon as it was pumped in, you got the Cambrian explosion of animals. There's a reason why you don't get animals until very late. There simply isn't enough oxygen to support those animals. There's a reason why you don't see fish in the oceans until really late. You have to wait till the oxygen level hits that. But the moment it hits it, you have this explosion of the creation of different animal life forms. If you want to know why God waits so long for birds and mammals, they need 20% oxygen. So there's a second big event where the oxygen goes from 8% to 10%, and then suddenly it jumps up to 20%. As soon as it hits that, you've got birds flying in the sky. Birds aren't going to make it on just 10% oxygen. They need that 20%. And by the way, you do too. Okay, you're first.
I'm sorry, the thing was being passed around. I missed a little bit of the first part, so just to get it straight in my head. When the Earth was formed, the Bible says the water was on there, right? Then we get bombarded with the Hadrian or whatever, right? All that. And then you get the late veneer. After that, it dries up.
Well, I never mentioned the timing. So that's a good question you're asking. Let me give you a quick history of how it happens. Okay. 4.57 billion years ago, approximately, you got the solar system forming. Okay, about 50 to 100 million years after that, you got the moon-forming collision event. And that's a time when you got lots of big, what they call planetesimals, floating around the solar system. These are bodies that are like 100 to 3,000 kilometers across. Basically bodies about as big as our moon. They're floating all over the place. And this is generating chaos. But once you get past the moon forming event, the big stuff is gone. But you still got lots of small planetesimals around. And that's the late veneer. And the late veneer kicks in about 100 million years after the moon forming event. Okay, then you got about a half billion years after that. And what's happening during that half billion years is that you've got movements of the gas giant planets. And those movements, that's a whole other story. Those movements actually set up the configuration of planetary orbits that you need for advanced life. And that doesn't settle until 700 million years after the solar system is formed. So no life is possible for the first 700 million years. So so just to kind of get the story, you got the formation of the solar system. And by the way, it's more exotic than that. For our solar system to have all the elements you need for advanced life, it must form close to the center of our galaxy, because that's where you're going to get a rich enough spot. And if you want, I could show you a graph. I should probably have all these for you, but I don't. But it'll be in the book.
This is the new edition of Why the Universe?
No, this is the book called Navigating Genesis.
Oh, so Navigating Genesis?
Yeah, and I'm working on another book, which is going to be Why the History of Life Looks the Way It Does. And this is kind of what I'm weaving in for you.
Sorry.
Not a problem. But yeah, if you were to look at our galaxy, at the center of our galaxy, the abundance of heavy elements is relatively low. There's reasons for that. But as you move out from the center of the galaxy, it reaches a maximum. Then it declines from that maximum. Then it comes up again and it declines. Okay? So there's actually a spot out from the center of our galaxy where you've got, quote, a minimum level of these heavy elements. Although if you go way out, you get another minimum. Okay. But in order for advanced life to be possible, our solar system must form in a really gigantic cluster of stars. We're talking 10,000 stars. And they have to be jammed close together. That's the only way we can get enriched by the metals from supernova eruptions and red giant stars and white dwarf binaries, and I won't go on with the rest of the list. But that's how we get enriched. And once we get enriched, what happens is some supergiant stars move in the vicinity of our solar system and gravitationally kick our solar system out, and kicks it way out about, kicks it about halfway out from the center of our galaxy. So it's a huge kick out, but drops it in the spot where you've got the safest spot for life. That's where the abundance of heavy elements is a minimum. That's where the star density is at a minimum. And that's where you got the most stable orbit around the center of our galaxy, and where you cross spiral arms the fewest number of times. So we start off in a very dangerous place, where we get enriched with all the stuff we need, then we get kicked out. Then we settle into the safe zone, and once we're in the safe zone, that's when you got the moon forming event.
How do we get settled in that safe zone and not stay in an elliptical orbit around the
Oh, no, we are in an orbit around the center of our galaxy.
Elliptical orbit defined by that kick out by the supergiant stars and, say, a paragalaxy point close to the center of the galaxy.
Well, we're just inside what's called the co-rotation distance from the center of our galaxy. And so we got kicked out quite violently. I mean, we're talking about moving, 24,000 light years. That's how much of a kick we got from this birthing spot that we were in. So we had this birthing star cluster, this violent kick. But once you get kicked out at a high velocity, but that velocity begins to slow down because of the spiral structure of our galaxy. And then once you get close to the co-rotation distance, it actually settles in. And so we've been at just inside the co-rotation distance literally for the past 4.5 billion years.
We basically don't have just the two-body Keplerian situations initiated by the kick.
Oh, no, it's more complex than that.
We have slowing down by the rest of the galaxy, pieces as we go by.
Yeah, and by the arms, etc. But the whole point is we've settled in into what is the safest spot in our galaxy. We started off in one of the most dangerous spots, and now we've settled into the safest spot. And once we're in that safe spot, that's where all this planetary dynamics takes place. Because, even though you're in the safe spot, in terms of the galaxy, we're not safe in terms of the configuration of the solar system. And of course, as we're being kicked out, that's going to generate some chaos in the planets. But now things begin to take place to get all that taken care of.
You were doing the timeline.
I was doing the timeline.
The timeline again. So if you could give us the timeline without any questions for a moment, because I
all right.
Not understand the timeline because we get interrupted. Just give us the synopsis of the timeline.
4.57 billion years ago, we're born in this gigantic cluster close to the center of our galaxy. And within just literally less than 10 million years, we get kicked out of that birthing spot and sent to this zone about halfway out from the center of our Milky Way galaxy. Now, once there, you've got the moon-forming collision event, which happens about 50 to 100 million years after the solar system is born. And then you go 100 million years past that moon-forming collision event, that's when you have this late veneer that brings in the water and the atmosphere that was eliminated by the moon-forming event. And then for the next half billion years, you've got a reconfiguration of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Because if they stayed where they were, they would have disrupted the Earth's orbit. And that's a whole other story. I wasn't going to get into that. I mean, I just wanted to restrict myself to the late veneer. Because there's actually six amazing things the late veneer does for us. I've gotten to two of them. Okay.
No, finish the timeline.
All right. Gotcha. Okay. So. Okay. Now you've got the late veneer. Then you've got another half billion years where the gas giant planets are being reconfigured, where they now have circular orbits and at the right distances so they don't disturb the orbit of the Earth. And this is where you got what's called the jumping Jupiter effect taking place. That's a really fun story that I'm not going to say much about. But now that we got the gas giant planets in place, this is when you get the late heavy bombardment. In fact, the last event in terms of the reorientation of the gas giant planets is where you got Jupiter making two orbits of the Sun for every single orbit of Saturn. And this is what destabilizes the big asteroid and comet belts that are beyond the orbit of Neptune, predominantly what's called the Kuiper Belt. The Kuiper Belt at one time was an enormous belt of asteroids and comets. By the way, we see Kuiper Belt-like belts around other stars. And so we know the solar system started off with a really enormous one. But it was this what they call resonance in the orbit of Jupiter and Saturn that destabilized that Kuiper Belt and caused a massive rush of comets and asteroids from this very distant belt. So the late veneer is stuff that's close to Mars, Venus, and Earth. But the Kuiper Belt is beyond Neptune. And it's that stuff that came in and caused the late heavy bombardment. And that peaked on Earth 3.85 billion years ago. So, for example, when you look at all those craters on the Moon and on Mercury, they were predominantly generated by what's called the late heavy bombardment. And what that did is it reconfigured the surface of the Earth, basically put the Earth's surface back into a molten state, but it also delivered the final ingredients we needed to set up a permanent magnetic field. Say, why do you want a permanent magnetic field? That magnetic field surrounding the Earth is what protects us from solar radiation and cosmic radiation. So that's one of the things we thank God for in Thanksgiving, are the Van Allen belts set up by our magnetic field, which makes sure that we live long enough to enjoy our Thanksgiving dinner. But the other thing that magnetic field does is it prevents this atmosphere that was delivered by the late veneer from being sputtered away. Okay, because solar radiation impinging on the top of the atmosphere actually would work to sputter away our atmosphere to interplanetary space. Our magnetic field prevents that from happening. So, but that was, 3.85 billion years ago.
When did the water come back?
The water came about, 160, 170 million years after the birth of the solar system. So it's way before the late heavy bombardment. The late heavy bombardment would have brought some additional water. So some additional water came.
After the veneer and in between the heavy bombardment, the water came from like comets?
The late veneer brought the water. The late veneer brought the atmosphere. Then you got the reorientation of the gas giant planets over the next half billion years. Then you got what's called the late heavy bombardment, which is the stuff coming from the Kuiper Belt, which comes and impinges into the Earth, and that actually brought additional sulfur and oxygen to the core of the Earth, which turns out to be crucial for plate tectonics and our strong, steady magnetic field. And then the next thing in the timeline is the origin of life. 3.825 billion years ago, you got the origin of life on planet Earth. Now, all the stuff that was going on was getting ready for the origin of life. There could be no origin of life unless all these events took place first. So the first 700 million years of the history of our solar system is getting our planet Earth ready for the origin of life. And you say, do you really need all that for the origin of life? You don't, if all you're talking is one bacterium that feeds on chemicals. What we notice is the origin of life on planet Earth had those very simple bacteria, but they also had cyanobacteria, bacteria that are engaging in photosynthesis. Because it was God's goal to get the planet ready for us human beings as quickly as possible. And so what God was looking for was setting up conditions here on planet Earth where the origin of life could include photosynthetic life of many different species. And it's because of that that we're able to get things ready as quickly as we did. In fact, there's one thing I'm writing in this book is just the amazing miracle of getting the planet ready for human beings in only 3.8 billion years. It'd be so easy to take a lot longer. And you don't want to take a lot longer because the sun's getting brighter. And it won't be long before the sun's too bright for human life or any kind of life. And so it's basically God on a very rapid race trying to get the physics and chemistry ready for us human beings as quickly as possible. And this means having the origin of life on planet Earth as quickly as possible. And that can't happen unless you're messing with all the planets and these late veneer, the late heavy bombardment in exactly the way that I've been describing. Okay, now I'll take some questions.
Thank you.
And this gentleman way in the back, you've had your hand up. Go for it.
For a long time,
right. And pardon me, it's sometimes my vision doesn't get to you, so I apologize.
You brought another question while you were talking. The original question is, why is the ocean salty? And the other question is, somewhere in Genesis, there's a statement where he separated the waters from the canopy or something. Is that what it means when the water was not here yet?
Okay, I mean, it tells us in Genesis 1, creation day 2, let there be waters above and waters below, which I believe is a reference to the water cycle. And I think you can prove that by going to Job 37. I mean, that's part of the text we've been looking at in our class. Psalm 147 and Job 37 speak about God setting up this water cycle. And say, why are the oceans salty? Because when the ocean water is evaporated, what's evaporated is pure water. And so the salt does not get evaporated, just the water does.
No, but why is it salty?
The reason why it's salty is because you've got rivers running into the ocean. And so, for example, if you look at the Columbia River or the Fraser River that are running into the Pacific Ocean, they're carrying minerals that have been eroded off of the continents into the oceans. And those minerals are salts. And so you got rivers continually feeding salt into the oceans. And when that salt water is evaporated, you get fresh water, which means the salt remains, but the fresh water falls on the continents and it falls as rain. That rain runs over the continental land masses and carries more salt into the oceans. Now, on that basis, you would say the salt should accumulate over time. The reason why it doesn't accumulate over time is because of plate tectonics. And so, for example, ocean seafloor becomes future continents. And so the salt that accumulates there winds up being recycled as continents. And so it's a recycling process. And based on the aggressive nature of the plate tectonics, the saltiness of the oceans is going to reach a maximum level. And it's been at that maximum level for the last several billion years. So that's where the salt comes from. And that's why, for example, you can go to certain places on the continents and you got salt mines. I mean, there's actually places where you got salt deposits that are 1,000 feet thick. Well, what you're really looking at there is an ancient ocean bed that got completely evaporated and salt remains. So again, I mentioned the Dead Sea. You go to the south part of the Dead Sea, there's a huge salt plain because the Dead Sea at one time was bigger. And when it evaporated, it left behind this salt deposit. Well, we actually have examples where the salt deposit is literally 1,000 feet thick. That's just simply an ancient ocean. So that's how the salt gets recycled. Now, who is next? You are next.
Can the moon-making collision, where the planet that hit Earth and all the water disappeared, did that water create the Lake Lanier, or where did it go? Did it go into asteroids or into the atmosphere?
Yes, because when Theia crashed into the proto-Earth, the proto-Earth at that time had an ocean, probably 1,000 miles thick. So much more water than it has right now. And it takes that deep ocean in order to soften the collision enough that you don't wind up destroying the Earth. That also explains how you get a debris disk around this proto-Earth that makes the future moon. So that deep ocean water was crucial to getting the moon and the future Earth. But the collision event caused all that water to dissipate to interplanetary space as well as Earth's atmosphere. So after the moon-forming event, you have a proto-Earth that has no atmosphere and no surface water. And you say, where did it all go? Interplanetary space. And it just gets dissipated. Probably a lot of it winds up in the sun. Some of it winds up escaping the atmosphere. And so we need another source of water to replace the water that escapes. And so Lake Lanier that brings in the secondary source of water. Now keep in mind, water is one of the most abundant molecules in the universe. So the universe is loaded with water. And that explains why the primordial Earth was so water rich. And by the way, we're now discovering Earth-like planets. And they're coming in with somewhere between 200 to 500 times as much water as the Earth has today. So water-rich rocky planets are the norm, not the exception. But the moon-forming event made us bone dry. The Lake Lanier brought in a second source of water, but it's not nearly as rich as the original source of what formed planet Earth. So we wind up with a thin layer of water and a thin atmosphere. How thick was our atmosphere before the moon-forming event? At least 100 times thicker than it is today. And being 100 times thicker, there would be no lungs. Remember I said before, lungs don't work once the air pressure gets past a factor of 3 of where it is in this room. Well, there was a time when our atmosphere was 3 times thicker than that of Venus. Even if Venus had the right atmosphere, you couldn't breathe there because its atmosphere is 40 times thicker than ours. So that's a problem if you're planning a trip to Venus. So, okay, you are next.
One comment, one question. Comment about last week. Your reference to Jeremiah 23:5-6,
mm-hmm.
where the Messiah is called the Word of Righteousness.
Right.
Looking into the Hebrew, it is indeed Yahweh behind the word Lord in that verse. So, vine was a little convoluted.
Yeah, we had a debate last week about Jeremiah 23:5. Does it really say that the name of the Messiah is Yahweh? And yeah, Vine's word study was saying that...
It was a little weird.
Yeah.
To a better word, technical word. But I looked up in the complete word study Bible, and it says Yahweh.
Right. So it really is Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I've used that with Jehovah's Witnesses, and they do admit that the word is Yahweh. Also, I've talked to Jews. They do admit that the word is Yahweh. So it's really not an issue of dispute once you look at the actual original Hebrew. The Messiah is there given the name Yahweh. And you say, how did Jehovah's Witnesses deal with that? They add a verb to the text. But the verb is not there in any of the manuscripts. So,
okay, the question is, I've interpreted what you've said in the past, that the Mars, twice the size of Mars collision event with Earth, ripped out 99% of the atmosphere and water, and now you're saying 100%. So could you clarify that?
Well, they used to say that maybe there was a small amount of water and atmosphere that remained from the collision. This is when they thought they could get by with a collider that was only the mass of Mars or the less. The latest models are telling us that maybe even twice the mass of Mars is not enough. Because what we're seeing is that the deep interior of the Moon and the deep interior of the Earth have identical isotopic composition, which means that the collision had to be powerful enough to get that complete mixing. And to get that complete mixing, you need a bigger body. But when you got a bigger body, none of the atmosphere remains, none of the water remains. So that's kind of the latest models. I gave that update a few weeks ago where I talked about how astronomers are re-looking at the moon-forming event. Because for the past decade, they've been trying to find some simpler way of looking at the moon-forming event where we don't have all this nested design. And what they discovered in the process is that there's more nested design, not less. And as I mentioned here in the class, there is an article published in the British journal Nature, which, by the way, the editors are all atheists. Nevertheless, they added the statement from this fellow writing about these latest models that it's causing philosophical disquiet in their midst because of all the design that's coming through these models. Something else that's causing philosophical disquiet is the latest recognition of what the late veneer does. Now, before I take any more questions, let me give you the other four things the late veneer does for us. Okay. Now, the first thing it did, it gave us circular orbits and coplanar orbits. The second thing, it brought us the atmosphere and the water we needed for life. The third thing it does is it gives us gold, the platinum metals, and cobalt, and nickel, and osmium, things we need for advanced civilization. The fourth thing it does is that it brought water into the upper mantle of the Earth. Now, without that, because in other words, the late veneer pounded the Earth with enough force that some of the water was not just brought into the crust of the Earth or on the surface of the Earth, it actually went right into the mantle of the Earth and brought water into the mantle. Now, that delivery of water into the mantle of the Earth is what allowed the mantle to become convective. And if it never became convective, we would never have gotten plate tectonics. You know, it's basically what you've got going on in the mantle. The mantle is that region between the core of the Earth and the crust of the Earth. And it's kind of like a soft mineral compound. So it's slightly, it's kind of like a viscous liquid. But it took the delivery of water into the mantle to lower the viscosity enough that you could actually get circulation. And so when we talk about plate tectonics, you know, for example, we're sitting on what's called the Pacific Plate. And that Pacific plate has underneath it an eddy in the mantle. So there's a big eddy in the mantle that basically is attached to the tectonic plate that we're sitting on right now. And there's all kinds of these eddies. So you've got all these different plates. And it's the movement of plates against one another that produces the continents and recirculates the minerals throughout the Earth over the course of billions of years. But if it wasn't for the late veneer, there would have never been sufficient water put into the mantle of the Earth to drive these convection eddies that make possible plate tectonics. And without the plate tectonics, you could never have advanced life. Okay, two more things that the late veneer does for us. The late veneer total material that was absorbed by the rocky planets was only 1% the mass of the Earth. So it's not a lot of stuff. Just 1% the mass of the Earth. But our planet Earth, being the biggest of the rocky planets, got the lion's share. And so the late veneer actually made the Earth slightly more massive. You say, gee, 1%, that's not much. but the mass of the Earth is crucially fine-tuned for advanced life. So if we had a little more mass or a little less mass, we wouldn't be here. The mass of the Earth plays a role, for example, in our surface gravity, also plays a role, for example, in what gases escape to outer space and what gases are kept. It must be fine-tuned. The late Vanir gave us the last augmentation of the Earth's mass. And a number six is that most of this late Vanir are what we call carbonaceous asteroids. Now, those carbonaceous asteroids contain within them the chemical compounds that form the building blocks of the prebiotic molecules, which are the building blocks for the origin of life. It does not make prebiotic molecules, but it does make things like, carbonates or silicates that all are factor in to what you need for the origin of life. So nitrogen compounds, carbon compounds, would be crucial for putting together the prebiotic molecules, the building blocks of life. Now, as I said before in the class, we know that the primordial Earth had no prebiotics at the time of the origin of life, but it had the building blocks of the prebiotics, and a supernatural creator could take those building blocks and make life. Nature won't do it, but the building blocks would be here. And it's because of these carbonaceous asteroids that that stuff actually gets here. Now, three more things about the late Vanir. None of this works unless the mass of the late Vanir is fine-tuned. You don't want to pound the Earth too hard, and you don't want to pound it too lightly either. It's got to be just right. The timing has to be just right. And then the distribution of the sizes. Most of the objects that pounded us were like between 10 and 100 meters across. We got a few big ones, and we got some that were smaller, but the quantity and the distribution of the sizes must be fine-tuned in order to get these six factors that we need for advanced life to be possible. All this, by the way, is really up to date. Some of this stuff has only been published in 2014. So this is really brand new stuff that is just being discovered, because astronomers have been really busy looking at the moon-forming event and what's been happening to the planets. The late Vanir, in fact, I did a literature search. Only 19 papers have been published on the late Vanir, so it's kind of an emerging scientific discipline, and there was a time when they thought there was no late Vanir. What has really brought the late Vanir back into attention is the fact that we now know the moon-forming event made the Earth bone dry. So, hey, we got water. It must have come from somewhere. And the other thing was this discovery in Australia where they were able to actually determine a date for when the Earth was pounded by the late Vanir, and the date was about 100 million years after the moon-forming event. It's thanks to some zircons, because zircons can actually survive the melting of the Earth. So that's why we have this. And so because of that, the late Vanir is now back in the news of scientific research. But yeah, just as literally the last few weeks, we now recognize there's six big benefits we get from there. Now, somebody told me there was somebody, a hand over here. Yeah, John.
Well, I was just thinking, revisiting Genesis, a lot of people seem to be confused when they read these ordinal numbers for the days, and also the rule supposedly that if you describe an evening and morning, that it refers to a 24-hour period. And I'm just wondering how one could provide evidence that that don't necessarily dictate that the days be 24 hours.
Well, a book that you'll see coming out from me probably early fall, it's been written, for a year and a half, but it's sitting in our editorial department. By the way, you can pray for reasons to believe we do not have the editorial staff to keep up with all the books that our scientists and theologians are generating. So yeah, I got a book that's kind of sitting there in the limbo, but do pray for us that we can actually get things moving. But it's called A Matter of Days. It actually gets into your question. I wrote a book on that theme back in 2004. The reason why I'm coming with a new book on it is that not only is the scientific case much stronger, but the theological case as well. And a lot of credit goes to two theologians who've been volunteering significantly for reasons to believe. One is Walt Kaiser, who's probably one of the most outstanding living linguists and definitely a committed Christian. Another fellow is a physicist who's probably one of the top Hebrew linguists. I mean, he's an amazing guy. He's a member of our San Jose chapter, Rodney Whitefield. So I was asking Walt Kaiser, what do you think of Rodney's work? He says, I use this stuff all the time in my courses. So, but Rodney is responsible for developing some of the best arguments for why those days must be long periods of time and not 24 hours. And what he does in particular is show that the placement of the verbs in the Hebrew text is one way that you can get a tense sense, because in Hebrew the verbs don't have tenses like they do in English. But he says there's other ways that the Hebrew can tell you what happens first and what follows next. And typically in Hebrew the verb comes right at the front of the sentence. But he says notice in Genesis twice it doesn't. And there it's making a point about the chronology. In particular, it's making the point that the creation of the universe predates the 6 days, and the earth predates the 6 days. And one appeal he makes to younger creationists is, no matter what you think about the evenings and the mornings and the number of days, you've got an indeterminate passage of time between the creation of the universe and the beginning of day one. It could be billions of years, it could be millions of years, it could be anything. All the text says is that stuff happened before the 6 days. So that's one appeal he makes. The other appeal he makes is notice when you get into the 6 days, you have this phrase, and it was so. And he makes the point that the way the Hebrew is structured there, and it was so, means that the events of this day follow after the events of the previous day. Because right now there's a debate being generated by theistic evolutionists that there's no chronology in Genesis 1. So he uses it as an argument to prove there must be a chronology to Genesis 1. It's not just based on the number of days. He says the phrase, and it was so, doubly establishes that this is a sequential chronology of physical events. And then he gets into the whole argument of the evening and the morning and why these can't be 24-hour days. And it's something I've held since I was 17 years of age. When I first picked up a Bible, what I noticed was there's no evening and morning for day six. So that immediately told me the first 6 days may have a beginning and an end point, but the seventh day does not. Now, I think one reason, in fact, I spoke of this when I was in Houston and San Antonio a couple of weeks ago. Now, one of the problems why we have a dispute with Genesis 1, it ends too soon. It ends at Genesis 1:31. The chapter should really end at Genesis 2:4, because Genesis 2:1 through 2:4 talks about day 7. And when you look at what it says about day 7, there is no evening and morning. Only the first 6 days have an evening and a morning. And that's what motivated me at age 17, saying, well, it looks like the seventh day is not finished. So as I read on in the Bible, I found three passages, Psalm 95, John 5, and Hebrews 4, that all tell us we're still in God's seventh day. So that means the seventh day must be a long period of time. And then you can back that up with the fact that the sixth day is when the human male and the human female are created by God. But if you go to Genesis 2, Adam is made first and Eve is made later. Then you look at everything that happens between the creation of Adam and the creation of Eve, and you realize we're looking at a minimum of 6 months. And, you know, given that he was a man, maybe it was 6 years before he was ready to be actually united with this woman. So it's not easy to prepare a man for marriage. So, but just look at everything he did there. First of all, he's created outside the garden. He watches the trees in the garden grow. It takes time for trees to grow. God puts them in the garden. He tends the garden long enough to realize there must be more to life than gardening. Then God has a name all the soulish animals. We talked about this in this class, how God was introducing Adam to the three origins of life. Life is purely physical. Life is physical and soulish. Then he performs an operation on him, puts him to sleep, recovers from his surgery. Any of you who had surgery knows it's more than just a few seconds to recover from surgery. And then it gets introduced to this new creature. And what Adam says when he sees Eve is a hapa'am, at long last. And it was funny, when I was being interviewed by this pastor in San Antonio, he said, gee, I always thought the text said, whoa, man. And I said, well, I knew he was a Texas A&M grad, and I said, that might be an Aggie interpretation of the text. But yeah, it's Hapa'am at long last, and therefore the sixth day is a long period of time. And it has an evening and a morning. So the evening and morning cannot be a reference to a 24-hour day. It's a reference to something that begins and something that ends. And if you look at the Hebrew words for evening and morning, they have that as one of the possible definitions. That's simply referring to the beginning of something and the ending of something. And by the way, our English words for evening and morning have the same definition. So we speak about the dawning of an era of music or movies or whatever. And we mean that's the beginning of a long passage of time. Or the eve of a man's life. That means he's coming towards the end of his 90-year life here on earth. Okay, I'm going to get back to you, Ross, but you've had your hand up a long time, so go ahead.
I'm dying of old age.
Well, we all are.
I got two questions. One is the science, and the other is the theology. Oh, I must have missed something. So you say our source, our star, was in the middle, more or less, of the galaxy, and then it got kicked out. And how do we know it got kicked out? What tells us we got kicked out? How do we know that? And why did we get kicked out?
Okay, let me ask that question first, then we'll get to your theology question. Okay, the solar system's birthing star cluster was about 5,000 light years out from the center of our galaxy. And that's where you can have these really big, dense star clusters. And it's where you're going to have lots of stars quickly going supernova. And so supernova eruptions that make elements like gold and platinum, cobalt, nickel, etc., stuff we need for advanced civilization. Also makes the uranium and thorium that we're going to need to drive the plate tectonics and set up the magnetic field. So this is where we get enriched by having that special birthing location and being in that special cluster. But if we stayed there, we'd be in trouble because the density of stars would be so extreme it would disrupt the planetary orbits. So it's important that once we get enriched with all the elements we need for advanced life, that we leave. And so the reason why we know this must be the correct scenario, it's the only place where we can get the necessary enrichment. So that's where you had to be in order to explain why we have a planet that's so rich in these heavy elements. But what we see today is that we're in a safe zone. So how do we get there? We must have been gravitationally kicked out. And we actually...
The whole solar system
got kicked out. Right. Now, we actually see that today in astronomy. When you look at a dense star cluster, some stars will be ejected by gravitational encounters with big stars. So we're actually able to see that phenomena taking place in star clusters. It's rare, but it does happen. What's exceptionally unusual for our solar system is how far it got kicked out. So it's because, you know, we literally moved about 20,000 light years away from our birthing location in terms of the radial distance outward in our galaxy. So that is extraordinary. Well, that's the other thing that's extraordinary. We got kicked out 20,000 light years and nothing bumped us as we got kicked out. So this is one of the miracles that astronomers talk about, is how we got born in the right place and got kicked out to the right place and nothing happened to us. That would eliminate the possibility of advanced life. And as someone here was pointing out, you were pointing out that we got stabilized. I mean, it's amazing that we remain in this safe zone for the last 4 billion years. Okay, your theological question.
God made Adam and Eve, right? And he made him naked.
Yes.
Now, after Eve ate the apple and both they sinned, now they suddenly discovered that being naked was evil. Now, God made him naked, so he must have made him evil to begin with. And then he makes skin. He made skins to clothe their nakedness, so he must have murdered some type of animal to get their skins to make them their pants. So he was the first guy to murder animals. There you are.
Well, Al, you need to read the text carefully. Okay. Now, it is true they were naked. In fact, last week I talked about this debate I had with these Orthodox Jews, how they were claiming that the Garden of Eden was up in the mountains of Armenia. I said, it can't be. It's too cold up there to be naked. This is why I prefer the site around the Persian Gulf area, because it's warm enough there that you can be comfortable without wearing clothes. But what does the text say? The moment they rebelled against the authority of God, they felt shame. And it was their shame, well, because they realized they had offended their Creator. And now they were afraid, because they're worried, okay, this Creator is not going to like us anymore. He's going to judge us. It's kind of what happens to, say, your dog, when the dog realizes that he's done something that displeases you. Instead of coming towards you, he runs away, especially if he sees a switch in your hand.
they say, okay, if God is walking along in the cool of the evening, like he reacts to heat and cold like we do. He's walking along in the cool of the evening, and they were hiding from him. And he says, why are you hiding? He said, because we're ashamed. Like if he didn't know that.
Okay, this is something you're going to see in the book I'm bringing out, Navigating Genesis.
You're going to explain it all.
Why God asks questions.
Yeah, why does he ask questions? He knows.
Well, okay, he knows everything. Now, the best place to go for that is Genesis 4. And this also helps us understand what Adam and Eve were going through in the Garden of Eden when they felt the shame and became concerned about their nakedness. So really the text to go to is Genesis 4. And this is where, you know, you've got Cain killing Abel. And now Cain is terrified as he stands before God, because he knows God's displeased. And what God does is he asks him four questions. Now, the way those four questions are being posed by God, he knows the answers to all four already. But his goal is to get Cain to admit what he has done and repent and seek forgiveness. And what you notice in the text is Cain rejects every attempt by God to be reconciled, which is why God banished him. He says, okay, he's not listening. He's not willing to admit what he's done is wrong. And he's trying to justify himself. I'm not going to be able to help him. And so he gets banished.
But Cain goes on to become a king.
Right.
He doesn't die.
You know, God could have killed him on the spot. I think that's what Cain was fearing. Okay, I killed my brother. God's going to kill me. And God says, no, I won't do that, but you're going to be banished. And so he gets banished to this place, and that's where he builds a city. And
he became a king and enjoyed his life. That's what happened.
Well, I'm not sure he enjoyed his life, because if you read on in Genesis 4, it says, yes, Cain killed his brother. But then it gives you a genealogy of Cain's descendants. And then you've got Lamech, who's killing all kinds of people. And this is a presage of the flood, because you go from Genesis 4 to Genesis 5. What you see in Genesis 5 is a description in Genesis 6 of what life was like in the days before the flood, when everybody was killing their fellow man. In fact, you'll see in this book, Navigating Genesis, that the murder rate had to be at least 19 out of 20. So only one person out of 20 was dying by natural causes. 95% of the population or more died as a result of being killed by their fellow man. And it all goes back to Cain. So that explains one reason why God banished him. He says, if he wasn't banished, then this thing would have caused a catastrophe much more quickly. So, and basically God was using Cain as an object lesson to humanity of the consequences of doing evil to your fellow man. You may think you're only hurting one person. You're not. Look at all the people around Abel that were damaged by what happened. And you see that today. When a murder happens, it begins to impact the whole society. I mean, a lot of you know that my son was attacked and his friend that was with him got killed on the spot. Well, the killing of that young man had an impact on thousands of people. So, you know,
there might have been cannibalism at that time.
Well, there's nothing in that text that suggests cannibalism. But back to your question, the reason why God asks questions is to try to draw that person to acknowledge what they've done, to repent of what they've done, and turn around. That's what repent means, to turn from going one direction to going an opposite direction. And God's goal, and He works with all of us today, is to get every one of us to turn around, which is why He raises questions. I mean, I remember when I first read this Gideon Bible, it's like reading the Bible, questions came out of the text. And what I recognize is that's how God was trying to draw me to repentance, by bringing questions into my life that I couldn't answer. And I kept reading through the text to try to get answers to those questions. That's another reason why God asks questions, to see if you're actually willing to seek answers. Now then, what I write about in this book is this is actually good advice for those of us who are parents. If you've had a son or a daughter, and you see them doing something you know is harmful for their future, a good way to discipline them is to start by asking them questions. Okay, so we all know that's a great way to minister to our children. Well, we are children of God. God treats us the same way. He already knows what we've done. Just like I, as a father, when I see my son doing something, I know exactly what's happened. But I want my son to recognize what he has happened and not run from the consequences and actually come to me for a pathway of reconciliation. And I think that's the answer to the question. God's far more interested in reconciliation, bringing us back to the direction He wants us to go, which is why He was willing to die on a cross for us. That whole death on the cross was designed to bring us back to where we had that relationship, and now I need to turn the floor over to you.
Thank you. It is time to end our class. We have a few brief announcements. In the bulletin, be aware that the Wisteria Festival is next Sunday, which means parking will be difficult. So if you'd like to be at class on time, you may want to leave a little bit early because with Wisteria Festival brings a lot of people into our community. If you're not familiar with the Wisteria Festival, and that is to celebrate the largest blooming plant in the world that is here in Sierra Madre. Takes up about 6, 7, 8, 10 backyards just north of us here. They do tours of that, and there's also a festival in the park. And so that will be going on next Sunday. The next CASA trip is on the calendar, May 16th and 17th. We've talked a lot about that in the past. And then also Holy Week schedule is in the bulletin, so be aware things are going to be a little bit different this year. We will have a traditional Mont Thursday service here in Pritchard Hall. We will have a Good Friday service here in Pritchard Hall. But be aware that Sunrise service will be in Bailey Canyon again. But Easter service, we will have no class here, and Easter service will be down the street at Pasadena High School. Make sure you have that information so you don't come up here on Easter and wonder where everybody is. All right. Hugh, did you hear? You know, obviously, that China is really getting into the space race and building rockets. And so what I've heard is they want to go back to the moon. And when they get there, they're going to open a Chinese restaurant. It's going to have great food, but no atmosphere. Ross Hoagland. He led up to it. I'll talk about atmosphere. I couldn't resist.
Dave, it's not the Wisteria Festival, it's the Hysteria Festival. Morning, everybody. I can't say morning anymore. It's afternoon. Very quickly, dates for the next Skeptics Forum. Get out your calendar. June 1st and 2nd. June 1 and 2 for the next Skeptics Forum. And Dave announced it, but I'm going to say it again. May 16 and 17 for Casa de Dios. If you've never done this, it's a life-changing event. Go down to Mexico, help build a house for some family that doesn't have a house before you get there and has one when we leave in 2 short days. I am planning a hike for those of people who like to hike 2 weeks from yesterday. I call it the Nazi camp in the Palisades. I don't know if any of you have heard this. It's a wild story. If you don't believe me, Google Nazis in the Palisades. There's a set of steps that's the longest set of steps in the United States. It's 512 steps to go down to this. And I'm planning a hike 2 weeks from yesterday on the 22nd. So if anybody's interested, I've got flyers. Last time I did this, we had about 20 people to another place. So that's all my announcements.
Close the prayer.
All right. Jesus, thank you so much for this class. Thank you so much for all the people here, the way that we can worship you with our mind, as worship you as a whole person and not just with our emotions, Lord. Thank you. Thank you. We praise you. And we ask your blessing on each one of us as we go our way this afternoon. In Jesus' name, amen.